Excuse me.
So. Here we go, Master.
Okay, here we go.
Let's get started.
So it's a pleasure for us to speak to you here at TechEd, second last day of TechEd. I hope you are still energized by all the technical content. Very welcome to our session. My name is Robert Eichenseer. I work in Microsoft Corp in a team called TED, Technical Evangelism and Development. And our goal inside of our group is really to help you, you as a partner, you as a customer, to bring your software, your service, your solution live on Azure and make your software, your solution a success on Azure. And not just something that we port your solution, that it runs somehow on Azure. We also have a goal that we have a highly scalable, highly available solution from your service. And together with me on stage is my colleague, my teammate Mario.
Hello. Hi, everyone. My name is Mario Spusta. And so I'd say we work in the same team. I'm the Austrian, he's the German, so we might clash against each other sometimes.
No. But at least in football, most of the time, we win.
Oh, that was a bad one. Thanks. I'm going. Okay, so I think what we are going to talk about today is some architecture principles that we would like to share with you that you should consider when you really want to build highly scalable, resilient, and globally deployed services on the Microsoft Azure platform. And as part of that session, we kind of split it into three big sections, we'd say. The first one is we kick things off by catching you up or getting you on board where I guess most of you are. At least that's what we experience when we work with partners. In the second section, we talk about fundamental techniques for building and deploying globally scalable applications with resiliency built in. And in the third, so that's kind of the toolkit that Microsoft Azure brings you. And in the third section, we talk about real-world requirements and how we have implemented them with partners at an architectural level. So it's kind of a lightweight architecture design session, if you want.
Something like a best practice. So it's not something that we think this might work. This is something which is our daily work, which we work together with our partners on their solution, where we know that it works and where we already have proven that it is live and working.
Exactly. So let's get started.
Okay. Let me start with the starting point. Good slide. Okay, the next slide is a typical solution architecture. So as Mario mentioned, we work with the partners directly, so we work in the field. And most of the time, when we start our work with the partners, we see a multi-tier application. And I think everybody of you knows that multi-tier application. So we have a user interface, we have kind of a business logic, we have a data access layer, and then most of the time we have a storage. If it's a relational storage, if it's a NoSQL storage, if it's just a key value store, it doesn't matter.
Just to make sure that we are not talking about something artificial here, who has seen something like this before?
Or in other words, who is doing exactly this? Okay, just for the record, most of the audience has raised his hands. This is exactly what we see. And now, most of the time, a manager comes and says, hey, this is good, this is cool. Let us put all that stuff into the cloud, into Microsoft Azure, and then the magic happens. Because if we have that application in Azure, we can put a lot more people on that application. The application will scale, everything works, I earn more money, everything is cool. But the question is that the real world? Or is this something which might not work? Is this magic really happening? And is this the valid blueprint? Because most of you really raised his hand that you're doing exactly that approach. Let me show you something which I have prepared. And this is an application. Which I've prepared, which is exactly designed in that way. Let me enlarge. So I have a solution, it's just a web application, and I have a three-layer architecture. So I have a user interface, which is nothing else than an MVC application. I have an interface defined in its own, project namespace. Here I have the interface function, something like get customer by ID. I'm using an async pattern, so I'm already cool. I'm using the next generation keywords. So Mario, what do you think?
We are cool, yeah.
That's good, yes.
Just like your soccer teams.
So then I have a business logic. That business logic is just implementing that interface. let me decrease the font again. So it's just implementing the interface. Oops.
A Windows 10 feature? So yeah, you wanted Windows... to evangelize that?
Yeah, not really, but it's a Windows 10 feature, yes. So I just have implemented that interface in my business layer, in my business logic, and let me show you what the application is doing. I just start the application, and it's really a cool application. It will be in the next big thing. So when it pops up, I can read from a database a customer record.
You are a rock star.
Yeah, I am. I know. So I really now have get this customer record out of a SQL database. And yes, you know, this is just a pure stupid example, but this is the pattern. You have a multi-layer application, you access somewhere a data store, you read from the data store, you write into the data store. And now let us put that magical application into the magic cloud, and the magic of the cloud will happen, and we have a globally scalable, high available application. Do we? Let us prove that stuff. So what I also have here is, I would like to add a load test to my solution. So I have here a load test solution. I just say add a new item. And this new item is, where is it? Load test. Can I see it? Yeah, here it is. Here's a load test. Let me add that load test to the solution. It's the normal generic wizard. Yeah, the name is cool, scenario one. The load pattern, Mario, with
500.
500,
yes.
So 500, we just go for 500 users. Let me increase it here. So we have 500 users. We start with 300 users. Every 2 seconds, we add additionally 50 users.
So just to be clear, you deployed that before in Azure websites and you're using Azure SQL database and now you are kind of want to execute a load test against that.
Exactly. This is what I'm doing here.
Cool.
So I add now a pre-recorded load test, which is more or less just exactly what I've shown to you. I've started the application, I accessed the database, and I've just shown the result. So this is what I've done here. I just add that pre-recording, go to the next step, say, okay, I'm not connected over LAN. I have a cable DSL, 1.5 megabyte per second. Let me add a bunch of different browsers.
Especially Internet Explorer 5.5 is important, right?
Yeah, Internet Explorer 5.5, because it's one of the most used explorers that we see in the world. Yes, and that's it. And now let me run that load test. And because it's a load test, I'm using Visual Studio Online, because I have 500 users. And I have more or less, let me call it, a data center in a tablet here on stage. But simulating 500 users takes a lot of CPU power. So I'm using Visual Studio Online here, and I'm just scaling out my load test to the cloud, and there will be 500 machines started for me. And I have pre-recorded that stuff.
So that's the demo that we have seen, huh?
Yeah. So, and here I just kick off my load test, and it should work now. So it's going out to the cloud. It's looking for resources. I spin up 500 servers in the cloud, and they are now hitting my web page with the magical cloud ingredients, and it looks good, doesn't it? I have a cool performance. I have a good throughput. The application itself looks also healthy, but I'm wondering, why is the performance so good? And the performance is so good because I have 1,000 errors. Oops.
So that's cool.
Isn't
your
that cool?
Your application performs really well.
Well, at least it's fast. Well, it's not doing what it should do. I have 1,000 errors. Remember, I have 500 users hitting that web page, and I have 1,000 errors. The first error is nobody was able to hit the page, and then the second request for the querying the database, that was also not a success. So that's the reason why I have 1,000 errors. And now again the question, who is doing the same architecture in the room and who is doing the same deployment to the cloud? And this is exactly what Mario and I will talk today in our session. What can we do to make that happen, to make it scalable, to make it at least executable, that we don't get 1,000 errors just by putting an application, which we think is done with a well-done architecture, just putting it into the cloud and then receiving 1,000 errors. Mario, can you help me to figure out what I've done maybe wrong?
Maybe the first statement is, whoa, the magic of the cloud didn't work. And the second statement is, we need some additional magic to make the magic of the cloud working. And that is what we want to talk about in the fundamental techniques and technologies. section now. So the first thing, Robert, that I need to ask you about your application architecture is, did you design your architecture for scale out?
According to my Manager magazine, yes.
Okay, cool. So that means your compute instances are primarily stateless. Okay.
I'm not they really
should,
sure.
Robert, they should be stateless. They should be as stateless as possible so that you can scale out through a load balancing mechanism with whatever load balancing algorithm, like round robin or whatsoever. And I would even go one step further and say, yes, there are application architectures and solutions that require sticky sessions. They might work in Azure websites, for example. They do work, but I would try to get rid of them. If you really want to scale, get rid of them. And try to be as stateless as possible so that you can scale out your compute tiers. The cool thing, and referring back to one of the announcements that we have made over the course of the past 3 months, is that in Azure, you have an external load balancer since the very beginning, back in 2009. But since 3 months, we also have an internal load balancer, which you can now even set up through the new preview portal, which was announced in the keynote on Tuesday. So you also can apply the same principles to your internal back-end app tier compute deployments. So that's one thing. If you still need state, then the clear recommendation is use in-memory caching on separate caching tiers. And there, our clear recommendation is if you start now something new on Microsoft Azure, you should use the Azure Redis Cache as a service offering, which we GA'd last week. That means it is generally available. It has an SLA back. If you are coming from an on-premises world where you are using the Windows Server App Fabric with the App Fabric caching, and you want something that is compatible without rewriting your code, then you also can use the Azure in-role cache as part of web worker roles. But, and that's one important point, don't use the Azure Shared Caching Service anymore because it will be retired. Either stick to Azure Redis Cache or in-role cache. That's the important message here.
So one of the learnings, Mario, is for my application, I had a state in my app, and my application was not prepared to scale out, to run on multiple machines. So that is one of the key learnings I should change in my application structure.
So, and that's the first step that you need to
okay.
do. But that's not all. Did you, by the way, next question, did you have any sort of complex CPU intense processing in your application, like generating a document or something like this?
Not in that application, but in V2, I will definitely have that.
Okay,
one. So
that you should outsource on a separate compute tier and process asynchronously, like having a separate worker role that runs in the backend that accepts things from queues. Or even better, since we announced on Tuesday Azure Batch as a Service, which is batch processing as a service in Azure, just make use of that and schedule a job with a bunch of tasks in Azure Batch, which are executed on separate compute cores and instances. And that is kind of the first high-level easy thing to do. Who of you is doing that already? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So to be honest, less than I expected. So I think then it was a good idea that we did talk about this. Another thing I suspect might be an issue in your application, Robert, is transient fault handling. Who knows what transient fault handling is? So again, 5, 6, 7 people. So when we access highly available services, like for example, when you access a database cluster in your on-premises network or an Azure SQL database in Azure, of course, sometimes failures can happen. So let's get back to this database cluster. Your database cluster runs, you access the database, you execute some transactions, and suddenly something might go wrong with your master node. So what happens in such a deployment is that you have a failover to the secondary node. Sounds pretty obvious. But when you try to access the database during that failover, your application will get an exception that will magically go away as soon as the failover is completed. So that is a typical example of a transient exception, and the way how to deal with these kind of exceptions is just to retry it again. And there are a variety of reasons for transient exceptions. So one of the examples that I've mentioned now is failover. Another example is throttling. So for example, when you use Azure SQL Database, there are different instance tiers like basic instance tier, standard instance tier, and premium instance tier, and they come with different throughput settings. So for example, the basic instance tier guarantees a certain amount of transactions per day. The standard tier guarantees a certain amount of transactions per hour, and the premium tier per second or per minute. So if you are trying to exceed those quotas, you will get an exception. And I guess that was the main reason why your application
failed. Maybe that was one of the main reasons, yeah, because what I've done is, because my manager told me, hey, please be careful with my money, I used the cheapest version of Azure SQL Database, and I didn't have the transit fault handling block integrated in my application. So that was one of the reasons why every single database request was refused, because the slowest or the smallest instance of the SQL server has a limit of 150 concurrent connections, and I was hammering with 500 at the same time against this service.
So what you need to do is you need to add transient fault handling into your application. And depending on which runtimes you're using and which frameworks you're using, transient fault handling is either built in or can be implemented with some third-party building blocks. And we want to touch base on both. Like, for example, the Entity Framework 6 in the .NET framework has transient fault handling built in. There are separate properties on the object context that you can set, which defines how the Entity Framework will deal with transient exceptions and retry operations against the database if there is a transient exception. Similarly, in Java, for example, when you use JDBC version 4.0, which is the current JDBC standard, it defines something that is called SQL transient exception, and you could make use, generally speaking, you could make use of those. Unfortunately, in the JDBC driver for SQL Server, we are not there yet, so you need to do manual retry. When you use the Azure SDK for .NET and access, for example, Service Bus or Storage, they also have built it in to the framework. And a built-in approach to the framework typically looks like this. So that's the entity framework approach, where you can define retry policies and attach them onto the SQL connection that is then used with the object context. So you just define the retry policy, say I want to retry it 3 times in an interval of 5 seconds between the retries, and then entity framework, or in that case the reliable SQL connection, retries SQL transactions 3 times before it gives up and raises the exception to your application. It looks very similar in the Azure SDK for .NET for almost all of the services.
So, Mario, if I want to use that functionality, do I have to use the full enterprise library, or is there maybe a...
Hold on. We are coming to that.
Okay.
So that's the next thing. So if you are working with a framework that has nothing built in for transient fault handling, we are providing a building block from patterns and practices as open source, which is called Topaz, or the Transient Fault Handling Application Building Block, so they are always smart with naming, which essentially allows you to define a retry policy and wrap your method that might run into a transient exception into an anonymous method as part of that retry policy.
So cool, I just go out to NuGet, install that NuGet
exactly.
package, and then I have all that magic, all that transit fault handling magic automatically integrated with some coding into my database access routines.
Exactly.
Cool.
And to answer your questions, as this is part of enterprise library, no, you don't need the full enterprise library. You can just use this library. They are fairly decoupled at the end of the day. It's just part of this bigger enterprise library thing, but you don't need the rest of enterprise library. So now we fixed your application at the compute tier so that you can scale out. We fixed your code in a sense that it is more resilient against temporary failures by including transient fault handling. The next thing that we will need to look at, especially when you run in virtual machines, is we need to make sure that you deploy your application with fundamental failure resiliency concepts being taken into consideration that Azure offers. And for this purpose, we need to talk about failure domains and upgrade domains as concepts. So who knows about failure domains and upgrade domains? Two. Okay. So let's explain them briefly. Both of them are organizational concepts in the way of how we deploy infrastructure in Microsoft Azure, both physically and virtually. A failure domain defines an area in a data center that has a single point of failure. Like, for example, in a rack-deployed Azure data center, a rack is a failure domain because every rack has one energy consumption that it uses, and it has one router or two routers that connects the servers and the fabric controllers of that rack to the rest of the data center. So when you want to be resilient against failures in that single failure domains or against update procedures, then you would need to make sure that you deploy your virtual machine instances across multiple failure domains and run with at least two instances. In platform as a service, so websites, mobile services, web worker roles, as soon as you run with more than two compute instances in those offerings, that happens automatically for you. That means if we run updates, for example, of the hypervisor, your service is not down. It's just maybe degraded for a short period of time until we spin up an additional resource on another failure and upgrade domain.
Okay, cool. That means when I'm doing this PaaS thing, this platform as a service, I don't have to take care about this.
Yes.
This is something we as Microsoft take care for you as long as you run two instances.
Or more.
Or more. And if you go to the infrastructure as a service world where you have your own virtual machines, we have to take care, or you have to take care
exactly.
about this.
Exactly. And I'm going to show that in the demo.
Cool.
Before that, I briefly want to talk about upgrade domains. So protecting against failures is one thing that you need to consider. Protecting your service against downtimes due to upgrades is the other thing that you need to consider. And for this, we have a second organizational principle, which is called upgrade domain in Azure. And again, as soon as you deploy more than two instances inside of a platform as a service offering, we spread those compute instances and service deployments across multiple upgrade domains. An upgrade domain is a unit in which we drive updates of the host operating system, the virtual guest operating system, or as well as application packages when you upgrade them as part of, for example, web worker or cloud service package updates. And we make sure that never ever we update more than one upgrade domain of your service at the same time. So if you are deployed across multiple upgrade domains, you can avoid downtimes due to updates wherever they are coming from. So again, for platform as a service, you get that for free. When it comes to infrastructure as a service, you need to take care of that.
And Mario, why do I have to take care if I'm in the infrastructure world? Because it's my VM, it's my software, I take care about the updates. Why do I have to take care about that?
That's a good point. So you're right. You are in charge of doing the upgrades in your own virtual machine. So you do the Windows guest operating system updates, but they are all running on a hypervisor. And on at least quarterly basis, we are upgrading the hypervisor and patching the hypervisor, which means that the VMs that are running on top of the hypervisor that we are patching will experience a short downtime. And that is why you need to make sure that you are deployed across multiple instances and upgrade as well as failure domains when it comes to virtual machines.
Okay, good to know.
And the concept that you need to take care of are availability groups. Who has seen availability groups before? So about 5 to 6 people. So when we look at virtual machines, what I have running here is an HPC cluster, high performance compute cluster. And the interesting thing is when I drill down into that HPC cluster and go to configure, and that is the setting that you should remember when you leave that session, and when you are using infrastructure as a service, is that I've created this availability set here, and I've added all of my virtual machines that belong to this same cluster to the same availability set, which makes sure that they are deployed across multiple failure domains and upgrade domains. So that is what you need to take care of. Just to prove that, These virtual machines are all hosted as part of a cloud service. So when I look into the cloud service, what I see when I go to instances is that they are deployed across 4 upgrade domains. Internally, we manage up to 8, between 8 and 9 upgrade domains at maximum per cloud service. So that's what we typically get.
So that means if we as Microsoft do an update of the host system, we just do it for one update domain, if that is good,
another. Yep.
And then we go to the next. This ensures that at least always your instances are up and running, minus the instance which we are updating right at the moment.
So, now coming back to, let's say, another example deployment, MongoDB. Who runs MongoDB in Azure Virtual Machines? A replica set of MongoDB, just one guy, okay. That's then not many. So MongoDB has this notion of one master for a cluster and several secondaries. If the master fails, then there happens an election between the remaining instances who becomes the new master. What does that mean in relationship to upgrade domains for MongoDB replica sets? You always need to deploy at least 3 virtual machines with a MongoDB instance in an availability set to make sure that when the master fails, at least 2 are there to elect who becomes the next master. Just having one doesn't work. Sorry. Just having one doesn't work. And that's really, really important to remember. So let's get back to the presentation. So these were failure domains and upgrade domains in actions for virtual machines. So now we have fixed the compute layer.
Yeah.
Next, we need to look at the database layer.
So we really now fix the compute layer when it comes to processes, when it comes to power to do something with the bits. But what do we do when it comes to the database layer, to the data tier? What can we do there? Because in my example, I was using just a small instance of SQL Azure. But just imagine I use the biggest instance of SQL Azure, but I have millions and millions and millions of users. What can I do there? And here we have the same principle. We have to bring the compute power or the database power to multiple nodes. And we have a couple of opportunities what we can do there. And one of the well-known, let me say, patterns is sharding. And sharding is nothing more than segregating the workload to multiple physical database servers. And this is here a good example where we say we have in total 5 databases, maybe running on different servers. And the first database takes care about customers who start with ABC, the second for DEF, the fourth for JKL, and we don't have any other customers, so we don't have Y or Z or whatever customers. And on top, we need a master database. And this master database just stores the information. Where is information for a specific customer stored? So more or less, this is just a store for connection strings. So if the application is asking for information for customer A, then it first queries the master database. The master database gives back a connection string, and then the business logic or the database access layer takes that connection string to connect to the right database and reads all the information from the customer out of that database. And that's the simplest example of sharding. We can go further. Because we also have something what we call a master-slave shard. And in that case, we are not just putting the data into different databases, we're also segregating due to the action what is operated. So, for example, if we have an application who is doing a lot of reads to a database, then we just have maybe 1 or 2 instances who are taking care about writes to the database, and all the others take care about reads. And behind the scenes, we have a replica mechanism in place, which just replicates all the information from the write database into the databases which are available for a read. And let me just give you an example. If we think about a ticketing system, maybe a ticketing system for a concert, for a sports event, it's not that often that you do a write, that you have new events. But it's very often, it happens all over the time, that people, users, are querying for the concert, for the tickets, what tickets are available, and so on. And that's a perfect example for a master-slave shard on the database tier. But we can also make it a little bit more complicated. And here we go for a peer-to-peer approach. And for that approach, all the shards take write and read requests, And we have a very intelligent replication mechanism in the back end who is just consolidating all the writes, all the reads. So this replica mechanism takes care that if a read goes to a database, which is not fully replicated from the write databases, that it just waits to get all the writes. So this is an example for a peer-to-peer. And the good news is here, if it's not a relational database, we already have something in our default offering, because Azure Table Storage is doing something similar. Who of you knows about Azure Table Storage? Yeah, most. Yeah, let me say half of the people know it. If you think just about the partition key and the row key, the partition key is more or less the shard ID, and the row key is the ID of the record inside of the specific shard. Well, to be honest, in table storage, we do a little bit more, but I think you get the principle, you get the concept there. And this is, or these are three mechanisms where we can also share our load of the database tier to different nodes. But again, who of you have already implemented such a shard mechanism? Okay, I see a few hands. The good news is, we have now something out of the box for you. And we call it Azure SQL Database Elastic Scale. It's right at the moment in preview, but you can already go to our website and check it out, download the bits, and play with it. And when we talk about Azure SQL Database Elastic Scale, let me talk about a few key concepts, about a few names what we have. So again, in the sketch, we have the developer, we have three shards, and we have an additional, and if you remember the first sketches, there was a master database. And this is something we have also here, but we call it the global shard map, or the database which carries the global shard map. And the global shard map is nothing else than a few tables inside of a database who stores information about the connection string and who stores information what data is in which shard. Now you could imagine if we just have one database with the GSM, it might be a bottleneck, because again, if I have millions and millions and millions of requests, and every request has to go to that specific master database, to that specific GSM, it can be a bottleneck. That's the reason why we also have local shard maps in the tenants, in the shards themselves. And to make it really fast, we also provide a client library which caches all that information. So in this building blocks, the global shard map and the way to get the information, where is the data stored, is never ever a bottleneck. And this is something we provide to you out of the box.
And it's not just a bottleneck, it's also a resiliency principle, because if the global shard map database is down for a second or something like that, I still have the shard map in all of the other databases.
Exactly, very good point. And then, to give you more flexibility, we also have administrative features. We have also administrative features in our building blocks. Because think of the following, you have in short all the customers starting with A, B, C, and D. But you have more D customers than you expected, and now short one is maybe a bottleneck. Now you have to move all the customers starting with B maybe to another short. And therefore, we also have management capabilities for you, which can do this on your behalf. And to make it cooler, when you query that information, we have queries which go to a local short, and we also have cross-shard queries. So something like a select all from against all shards. Because again, think about a ticketing system. When you do a read, maybe for a specific event, you know maybe which shard you have to go to. But then later when you do statistics, when you want to do how many users from which country are going to a specific event, you maybe have to query all of that shards. And therefore, we also have a mechanism. But I will show you in a minute some source code. There is also a caveat. There is something you have to take care when you use the cross-shard queries. So that's about, let me say, the theory. Let me jump into code. Because here I have prepared something in my example which shows you how you can use our Elastic Scale libraries. So first of all, what I have done is I have created a couple of databases. So here they are. Let me enlarge it. So I have a database called Globally Scalable. This is the database which carries my GSM, the global shard map. And then I have a shard 1 and a shard 2.
So you said you have created the databases.
Exactly. Okay. I have created the databases using a database script. And this is what we learned when we worked with the field. that especially in bigger companies, there are database admins, and the database admins really do not like when a developer comes with a script, maybe automatically executed by its code, and creates databases, modifies schemas, introduces foreign key relations, and so on. So this is something, and here I have the creation script. Here it is. So you can decide, or the database admin decides, how does he create the databases, the schema of the databases. And yes, he has to take care that all shards have the same schema. If you do not control it from an application, the database admin has to do this. But this is the daily business of the database admin, to keep the schema in the right place, in the right shape.
Okay, but it means at the end of the day, when you use Azure SQL Database ElasticScale, the DBA needs to prepare all of the shard databases, and he uses plain T-SQL stuff.
T-SQL.
So there was nothing special in that SQL script, was there?
No, there was nothing special in that SQL script. It's just plain T-SQL to create the database, to create the tables.
I'm just curious. I mean, does that work on SQL Server on-premises as well, then?
The good news is yes. Because it's just plain T-SQL. It's not something, and maybe you know it, we also have a functionality, what we call SQL federations, where we had a special, let me say, language descriptioner.
Who knows about Azure SQL Database Federations, the predecessor of this technology?
So we see
nobody.
Two hands.
That's good. So just three of them, just forget about Azure SQL Database Federations, and the rest don't learn about it. Just jump directly to Azure SQL Database ElasticScale. The name also sounds cooler, does it?
Okay, and that's the code. If you really look to the code, it's pretty simple. So first of all, you have an object called Shard Map Manager Factory. That object comes in by a NuGet package. Just go to NuGet and search for Elastic DB Scale, and then you get these objects out of the box for you.
So that code here is provisioning code.
Exactly. So that provisioning code, which is just executed once. Meaning, here you decide, where is my GSM, how are my shards configured, what keys do go to which shard, and so on. So this code is just executed once. It's a provisioning code.
Okay, cool. Okay. But you have just included it for simplicity.
Into that example. Okay. Exactly. So here I start with the Shard Map Manager factory, and I try to get the SQL Shard Map Manager. If I get it, it's cool. If not, I again use the Shard Map Manager factory to create a SQL Shard Map Manager. And the only parameter I provide is a simple connection string to a database. And this method just creates the necessary table structure inside of that SQL database. And the next thing is, I do the sharding. And in this case, I use a so-called range shard map, meaning I can decide a specific range which goes to a shard. So I can say, for example, customers with the ID 1 to 5 go to shard 1. Customers with the ID bigger than 5, maybe smaller than 10, goes to the shard number 2. So, and this is here just a shard map which I've created, or which I'm creating here. And the next code is all about the shards themselves. So here I create a new shard location with a server name, and again with a connection string. And this is more or less, I tell the GSM, look GSM, you have a physical database, and this database is located there. I just tell the GSM there are physical databases by executing this code with the shard location. And then at the end, I just say, here is my range mapping, create the range mapping, and here is a range mapping starting from 0 to 5, and all keys 0 to 5 go to shard number 1, and all keys 5 to 10 go to shard number 2. And when I say key 1 to 5, means a key you can decide. It can be an integer, it can be a string, it can be a data type you have under your control. And this is the key to decide which shard is taking care of reading and writing that information. So that's the provisioning part of it. As already mentioned, it just needs to be executed once. And if you start querying the data, it's pretty simple. It's just what you have done also in the past. I've chosen here a plain old ADO.NET example, but you can also use an entity framework example. We also have objects for entity framework there. So what you're doing here is you start with a SQL connection, and you get the SQL connection from the shard map, open connection for key, and here I say for key number 1. And maybe I'm querying now the customer with the ID number one. So I go to the range shard map and say, hey, range shard map, please give me the connection string or open a connection for a specific shard. And you, range shard map, you know which shard the information is located. Just give me the connection. And then starting with the connection, it's just what you are used to do. You create a SQL command, you execute a SQL data reader, and then you just read with that connection, with that connection string. And this is what we call the data-dependent routing. So you have a key, you just query the Elastic Scale libraries, please give me the right connection for that key, and then you execute your SQL statements against that connection.
So the typical use case for that would be something like a multi-tenant architecture where you have a one database per tenant approach. Then the key here would be the tenant, for example.
Exactly. And the second example, what I have prepared for you, is a multi-shard query. Again, think about maybe statistics, where you have to query all the shards. Again, the ticketing system, where you have to have information, how many tickets have I sold, in which regions are the customers, and so on. And here we have something similar. It's also pretty simple, but here you start with a so-called multi-shard connection. And then, based on that multi-shard connection, you create a multi-shard command. And with that multi-shard command, again, you just execute SQL statements, and then you can execute readers. You can also use the entity framework here, but here you are doing a multi-shard fan-out query to multiple databases. And keep in mind when you do that, when you do really a multi-shard query, it's a fan-out query to all shards. The information from all shards is coming into our library, and then we do something like a union all to get one record set, which you then can process. It's a cool feature, but use it wisely, because it might have impact on performance and it might have impact on memory. It is a cool feature, but you should know what is the caveat when you use it. And this is something we provide really out of the box for Azure Elastic Database Scale.
So with that, at the end of the day, we scale out at the database and we distribute the load across multiple databases and database servers in our application architecture. And with that, we can even scale better. So now, to recap, we fixed the compute tier, we scale out at the compute tier, both with the externally visible components and compute layers as well as with the internal ones through the internal load balancer. We used Redis caching and things like that. Second, we added transient fault handling to our application to make it even more resilient against temporary failures, which is really important for high load scenarios. And now we addressed the database layer and we scale out at the database level. So we scale pretty good inside of a single data center. Yep. But we are still in a single data center. So let's expand the scenario and let's say, okay, we just want to serve more than one region, or we want to fail over for disaster recovery reasons from one data center to another. And that essentially means, in a simplified way, that you need to create all of these things that you have in a single data center a second time, and run it there a second time, and then route users appropriately. And for that routing, we want to talk about a component which is called Traffic Manager, Azure Traffic Manager, which is essentially a DNS-based load balancer that allows you to hide multiple deployments across multiple, that are eventually even deployed across multiple data centers behind a single DNS name. And that load balancer then can distribute requests across those multiple endpoints in the different data centers. And there are different policies like round robin or failover, where you define one master, and if that fails, it goes to a secondary. And that's the first thing that we need to talk about when we want to be globally available and globally redundant. And for that, we have also prepared a little demo with the Azure Traffic Manager. So first of all, I'm going to look at two Azure websites which I have deployed. So I have one that is called MarioSCP trafficus.azurewebsites.net. So that's the US one. And when we look at show traffic manager info, it says I'm hosted in West US, USA West site. And then I have a second one that is MarioSCP traffic EU. So that's my European deployment. So these are essentially two websites. So that's the North Europe. If I do the same thing in this browser with Mario SZP Tech at 14.trafficmanager.net and hit enter in my local browser, what it indeed will do is it will redirect me to North Europe, since we are here in Europe and I have hosted a website in Europe and I've configured Traffic Manager to put me to the lowest latency endpoint. If I would do the same thing in a machine that is deployed, let's say, in the US, like this virtual machine that I've deployed in Azure US, and I fire up a browser there and do exactly the same thing. So I copy, paste the URL into this browser here, say paste, enter, and I show the traffic manager here right now, it's going to say, West US is closer. So that's just one policy that you can configure the traffic manager with.
Just to do a recap on that, that's cool, isn't it? Because think about stock trading, where you really have to go to the closest location, where you really have to route the user to the location with the lowest latency. And using that traffic manager, and Mario showed that, just with a simple rule, you can decide, or the traffic manager decides on your behalf, which is the nearest data center for you and routes the traffic to that specific data center.
So here you see the websites again. So when you configure the traffic manager, you go down, 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 and you click the traffic manager button. And there I have configured a traffic manager, and here you get the endpoints. And you can add both. You can add Azure-hosted services in here, but you also can add hosted services that are running in your own data center. Just don't look for that option in the management portal because it requires PowerShell scripting to add an external non-Azure hosted endpoint. In my case, I have these two endpoints configured here, which is my EU website and my US website. And when I go to configure, there is another interesting aspect that we would like to talk about. So other than the policy like failover, load balancing, or whatsoever, so here are the policies, performance, so closest location, round robin, just evenly distribute the traffic across my data centers, or failover, which would mean I define one primary, one secondary, and then if the primary fails, I redirect everything to the secondary. But the other thing that we find here is we have here an endpoint that we need to configure in Traffic Manager, which allows Traffic Manager to ping whether my website is up and running. And that endpoint needs to respond within 5 milliseconds with an HTTP 200 OK. So,
Mario, does that mean that I, as a user, have the full control when the Traffic Manager switched to the other data center?
Yes. So when I look at, for example, our sample implementation here, in our MVC application, we have an Azure Traffic Manager controller, which is an ordinary MVC controller. And in our ping method, when you look at what we are doing is we are reading some configuration information from an Azure table. And in the Azure table, I store whether the website is offline for maintenance or not. And if the website is offline for maintenance, then I throw an HTTP exception. So if I do that, then the traffic manager would say, hey, that site is not available. I'm not going to redirect traffic there. So you can take the site offline by yourself if you're in bad logic like this, and then redirect users to the other site as long as you're doing maintenance work, for example, in one of the data centers. And that's a very important concept that you need to consider when you are deploying across multiple regions and using the traffic manager. But the traffic manager is just one instrument that we have for globally distributed solutions in Azure. So traffic manager covers redirecting of requests to your compute instances. But then when let's assume you have two deployments, of course those deployments most likely will use databases and storage. So what do you do with that? And there are a bunch of out-of-the-box solutions which we are going to look at, but we also want to highlight the limitations of those since we have some partners where we need to work around of them. And we're going to start with storage, Azure storage. So blob storage, table storage, Azure file shares, and Azure queues. In Azure storage, you have essentially four redundancy options. Locally redundant, which always stores three copies of your data inside of a single data center. And the other extreme is geo-redundant storage, which stores three copies of your data across two data centers in the same geography. Like, for example, Dublin replicates to Amsterdam, and Amsterdam replicates to Dublin. And that geo-redundant storage comes in two flavors. One is geo-redundant storage, and the other one is read-only geo-redundant storage. What is the difference? When you select geo-redundant storage, then we replicate the data for disaster recovery and to avoid data loss if something goes wrong in one data center, but you don't have access to that data in the secondary location until we, as Microsoft, decide, okay, we cannot recover the primary location anymore. Now we give you access in the secondary data center. Versus geo-redundant read-only storage gives you read access to the data always in the secondary data center as well, but only read access. And when we think we cannot recover the primary location, then you also get write access. So for these things, like when we think we cannot recover, then we fail over, that's the recovery time objective, RTO. And we, as Microsoft, don't specify an RTO, and we don't guarantee to any RTO time. Since we say we try as much as we can to recover a site, if there is at least a minimum chance to recover a site before we fail over, because there is a time window of 15 minutes where we might have potential data loss, and that's the recovery point of objective. So that's the time it might take to asynchronously replicate data from one site to another site. And these are the two factors that you need to be aware. And I'm working with a customer in Spain where they say, if we need to fail over, we need to fail over in a full active way. So we cannot wait for 24 hours till we get write access to the replicas in the secondary storage. We need immediately read-write access. That means we need to work around that, and we are talking about a service bus-based solution at the end of this presentation, how we are going to work around that architecturally. So that's the storage side of the house. There is, by the way, one thing in between geo-redundant and locally redundant storage, which is a mixed variation of those two extremes, because the locally redundant is cheap, the geo-redundant is a little bit more expensive. If you want to have less expensive but still replicated data across multiple sites, then you can use the zone redundant storage, which is a mixture of those both, where we say, okay, we have three replicas, we store two in one data center and one in another data center. So that's the storage side of the house. The other side of the house is the database side of the house. So when you're using SQL Server or Azure SQL Database or any other data platform. And for setting up geo failover in this world, we need to differentiate between things that you host in virtual machines, in infrastructure as a service, and platform offerings such as Azure SQL Database or ClearDB, which is MySQL as a service in Azure. When it comes to infrastructure as a service, the way how to set up geographic failover that we enabled a couple of, I think, two or three months ago, is to set up a cross-region virtual network, which is one virtual network that spans two regions, so two data centers in different in different locations. And in that cross-region virtual network, you can deploy things such as a distributed SQL Server always-on cluster, or a distributed Cassandra cluster, or a distributed MongoDB replica set, where, for example, two nodes sit in the primary location, and then another two nodes sit in the secondary location.
Mario, does that mean something like I have a SQL Server running maybe in Dublin? It's the active SQL Server, and then I have another server running maybe in the West US data center, and if Dublin goes down for any reason, I still have my data running in the West data center?
Yes. So if you set up a SQL Server always on availability group across those two sites, yes. The only thing I would consider with this setup, so Europe and US, is whether that's legally okay. So maybe Europe and Amsterdam or something like this would be more appropriate for a failover scenario. But other than that, but this scenario works as well, so across the sea, if you want so. The point here is you need to manage that by yourself. You need it set. You need to set it up by yourself in virtual machines. If you don't want to do that, you can, for example, in SQL, in the SQL world, you can use Azure SQL Database, and there are two options for geographic failover. If you use the Azure SQL Database standard tier, we have an offering that we call GeoRestore. So to give you some background, since we have the new instance tiers of Azure SQL Database, basic, standard, and premium, who is aware of those? Okay, half of the group. So since we have those, we are also keeping regular backups of your databases, and we keep them for a certain period of time. That period of time is different from basic to standard to premium. As soon as you pick standard, we even geo-replicate those backups. So if one site fails, you can restore that backup in another site and spin up a SQL Azure database based on that geo-restored database. That's standard edition. In premium, we go one step further and we say we have active-active deployments where you have a primary Azure SQL database in one region, and then you can have as many secondary nodes as you want in other regions, which are always active, always on the same level as the main master, and also accessible for read-only access as soon as you script to fail over to one of the other nodes or as soon as the main site becomes unavailable.
So saying that, that means we as Microsoft provide nothing more than a SQL always-on cluster as a service.
That's comparable, yes, exactly.
So, and I don't have to take
SQL
care...
SQL always-on as a service.
And I don't have to take care about updates, about having the right service, the right versions. It's just that I use the database with a connection string and I have an always-on cluster.
Exactly.
That's cool.
There's just one thing, again, you need to consider, and that's the RPO and RTO. And the best RPO that we can get to is to a maximum of around 5 minutes when we use Azure SQL Premium and the RTO to less than 1 hour. And if you cannot live with those limitations, then you need to build something into your architecture that overcomes those limitations. And that's what we are going to talk about
in the next section
as well. So let's switch gears to reference architectures.
Yeah.
Since we have prepared a bunch of reference architectures, and we are moving to them to not overrun and don't spare you some time from the Ask the Experts.
Yeah, so what we've seen so far is a broad range of a tool set. So we have seen Traffic Manager, we have seen all these new cool SQL Server opportunities that we can have. So more or less you now have a big toolbox, and you can use that toolbox to create out of this toolbox the solution which fits to your needs. But what we see sometimes when we talk with the partners, with the customers, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And you have a problem and you know, hey, there is a SQL Server always on as a service, that's the solution for it. And sometimes, just think of it, maybe it's not a nail, sometimes it's a screw and you need a screwdriver for that. And therefore, let us start with some scenarios where we just bring our best practices, where we say, okay, that's the way how we have used the tool set together with partners. And the first scenario, let us really start very, very simple. It's something where we say, don't lose the data in case of a disaster, but it is allowed that your service is not always up and running. The example that we stress here is, again, the ticketing system. If we create statistics based on the sold tickets, then this is a service, and if it's not running 24/7, if it's just available when the manager needs that data, when the manager wants to have that report, it's completely okay. And in that case, what can you do if a data center goes down? Well, just use our storage opportunities that we have. Because like Mario already mentioned, we have this zone redundant storage, and we also have the geo-redundant storage. So if a location goes down and you have the geo-redundant storage, you can spin up whatever you want, access the geo-redundant storage just with a read, and copy from that read or query the information from that geo-redundant storage and create the storage on your own. If it's on storage, table storage, blob storage, if it's in a SQL server and you have to recover from a SQL server, then just use the geo-restore capabilities of the SQL server. And this is a pretty simple example, but one rule: don't do it manually. Because we have seen this pretty often, that this failover, that this disaster scenario was done in a manual step. And most of the time when you have the disaster, the admin is not available. The admin is on holidays or has something else to do. So script that stuff. And also think about falling back to the original solution. And this is really the simplest example we can think of, where you can start with using all that possibilities of that toolbox that you have.
So the point here is, don't over-engineer the things if the requirements don't require you to over-engineer the things. Of course, I can always set up an active deployment and it's going to be more expensive, more effort, and so on and so forth. But if I can live with a downtime window and if I can define that in my SLAs, then that's a good enough approach, I'd say.
Okay, so let us switch gears. Let us say, okay, it's not allowed to go offline. Let us think, what do we have to do if it's not allowed to go offline, if the service must run, but maybe we can have some degradation in the performance. So the service is available, but maybe it takes a little bit longer. And here is also something, please keep it in mind, a graceful service degradation. If you have really a disaster, sometimes it's good enough for your users, for your customers, and this is something where we need your brain power. You have to decide what is good enough for your customers. Think again about this ticketing shop. You buy a ticket in that shop, and maybe the system which sends out the confirmation, the PDF creation system, whatever system is down, sometimes it's completely sufficient for the user that he gets a message on the web page, okay, dear Mr. Customer, we have received your order. We will inform you immediately within the next period of time, and we will send you the tickets. Instead of telling him, hey, basic disaster, error 500, blah, everything is going down. Disaster mode. Think about this service graceful degradation. But here what we start with an active passive, with a database. Again, Mario showed it. Start with the traffic manager and have in the main data center, this is what Mario is drawing on the left side, in your main data center, have the full capacity, have everything what you need in the best, let me say, configuration with all the performance you need. And then define something like a failover data center. And in that failover center, you just have reduce capacity. You still have all the capacity that it does not come to an error when the user hits your data center, because maybe you also have the transit fault handling in place. You have everything you need, but you have less compute power and maybe smaller database sizes and so on. So then the traffic manager can fail over to the secondary data center, and then using SQL Active Premium, then you can also fail over to a SQL server which is also already in your data center, in the failover data center, just by using SQL Active Premium with the failover possibility. And again, for the storage, you can read the geo read-only replication.
So I have a practical example, by the way, of that. Think of an internet banking solution, and I've been working on one of those in my home country, where the main data is stored, of course, in the SQL database, but that internet banking solution provides some added value service, like storing some documents in an online storage and things like that. If they fail over, for them, it's absolutely not okay if the data in the SQL databases is not available in the secondary site. So they do SQL Premium Active. But if they fail over, they definitely can afford that this document store is not available for a period of time until they have recovered completely. And this is exactly what Robert was referring to with graceful service degradation.
Okay, in that case, you have really an active passive scenario. Traffic manager fails over automatically, and you can run with reduced capacity. But if you have seen that carefully, there was a caveat inside. What was the problem there? 5 minutes of maybe being async in the SQL database. Because this is our let me say our rule, when we do this replication to the secondary data center, we really highly ensure that the database itself is transactional correct, but there might be a 5 minutes window where you lose data. And now think again about the ticketing system. And if there is, let me say, a rock star concert here in Europe, a big US band is coming to Europe, most of the time, the best tickets, the VIP tickets, they are sold out within minutes, and all the good tickets are gone. And now think we have exactly now a disaster when we sell all the tickets, we fail over to the secondary data center, and in that case, we sell the tickets again. And then that might be a situation we don't want to have. What can we do against this? And here again, we have something. So Mario is just drawing again the basic, let me say, setup. We have the active data center. We have the passive data center. But here we do something very smart. And here we need, again, your brain power. Because we decide, we develop a highly available data access component layer. And with this data access component layer, you write to the database, which is really in the active data center. And then as a second action, you write from that database layer to a secondary database in the remote data center, in the failover data center. And now you have the full control. Then you can say, okay, what do I need? Do I need big, the best performance ever? Then this is really the minimum requirement what you should do. If you say, okay, the performance is not this important, it's more important to be really, really safe. It's not allowed to lose any bit. Then you can decide to how many databases do you write before you confirm the writes to your business logic. Saying that, that means you write at least once to the local, you write at least once to the secondary data center, and then you can decide about your quorum. Maybe you write a second time to the local, maybe you write the second time to the remote data center. But the message here is, just by adding an additional write into your data access component, you have a failover scenario where you are pretty sure, no, not pretty sure, where you are sure that you don't lose data, that you don't lose any data. And this is really something which is live, which we have done in the field, and this is a proven practice to do it. And it's not just that we do that, that you develop maybe this data access component layer. If you use databases like Cassandra, if you use open source databases, there you have this motion of a quorum. And this is exactly the same pattern what you can do here. So if you're using Cassandra, you can get it out of the box. If you're going for a SQL, just add an additional write to your data access components, and then you have the possibility to fail over to a secondary data center without the loss of any data in the SQL.
There is one important point, and I think those of you who are working with NoSQL databases are aware of that, and that is one fact, one physical law. You cannot have both. You cannot have 100% reliability and consistency and 100% performance. You have to do a trade-off at either one or the other, and that is what quorum is all about. In Cassandra, for example, you can define that quorum depending on your needs. Or in Azure Document DB, for example, which also follows a multiple database scale-out principle, you also need to define that quorum behavior depending on your needs. So I think that's one important takeaway there. There is no silver
exactly.
or golden bullet.
There is no golden bullet. You can't have everything out of the box. It's always your decision. Performance, security. This is something where you have to use your brain power to go the right way.
And that gets even more extreme with the next scenario,
yeah.
I'd say, Robert.
So the next scenario is really the Formula One clause of architecturing for the cloud. We do something similar what we have shown to you. So we have, again, this active and now active again scenario where we have the traffic manager on top, where we have the data centers. One of them is fully deployed, the other is also deployed with maybe a smaller scale unit, but maybe also with the same scale units, with the same compute power, and we call it the geo-sharding. And in that case, with the geo-sharding, you say, again, if I stress the ticketing system, if I have an event in Europe, I route all users, even if it's a US user, if it's an Asian user, to the European data center, because the European data center takes care of all the traffic for that specific event. If we have an event, a rock concert in the US, the US data center takes care for all the transactions, for all the reads, for all the writes, for the databases. We also have the highly availability layer in place, or we do a geo-replication, which we provide out of the box with SQL. So it's the SQL Active Premium, what Mario is drawing here at the moment. So you can use that. You can also use your own data access component. And when it comes to storage artifacts, then what can you do there? When it comes to storage artifacts, we also have a service, what we call the service bus. And now Mario was already giving us the example with the bank who is creating these documents. And if a document is created, it's created in the storage. Again, there is a caveat of 15 minutes for the geo-replicated storage. And maybe that's not okay for you. What can you do there? So you write from your data access logic the write of the document into a service bus topic, and then you have logic writers running as their own workers in their own environment, and these workers, they just subscribe using a topic, using a subscription to the specific topic, and get the command, yes, I have to write something, and these writers, they write in data center A, and they write in data center B. And by doing that, you have a full control when a document is written in both data centers. And again, you can give back to your business logic, hey, there was a problem, I wasn't able to write into the remote data center, or you have it fully under control when you say, okay, it was written in data center A, it was written in data center B, it's now a commit to the business logic. And by using service bus, topic subscription, mechanism, combined with a highly available database layer, which you also define on your own, you really have the gold class of Azure scalability and global availability solutions reached. Because here you have full control, and again, you can't have everything. You can't have performance and the best security. You can decide. But at least now you have all the tools, you have all the proven patterns, which we as Microsoft know that they work because we see them already live in highly available and highly scalable solutions.
So this, by the way, is an architecture that we are working with a financial services company in Madrid. And they need an active deployment end-to-end. So geo-replication with read-only storage does not work for them because they need to be able to write and read documents from storage immediately after failover, as soon as possible. And that's why we do this manual write across multiple sites with service bus topics and subscriptions. Of course, one consequence of that, one interesting side effect of that is we have this additional development effort, of course, but from a storage perspective, we can choose the cheaper locally redundant storage because we are replicating by ourselves, first. Second, does that mean this company in Madrid can reduce their RPO, their recovery point objective, to zero? No, of course not, because there will be nevertheless a delay it takes for the service bus to distribute the messages and then process the messages across the data centers, but they can get way below the 15 minutes with that. And that's what they wanted to have, and that's why we came up with this solution for them. Okay. So, with that...
By saying that, let us go to a summary. Let us go to a conclusion. So, what you have seen when we started really with this small example of a multi-tier application, really carefully design your solution. The cloud gives you a lot of magic, but not all of the magic comes out of the box. Please use the right tools in your architecture, use the right services in your architecture, and the first point, what you always do, make sure that everything scales well in a single data center. When you have reached that step, then you can go to the next challenge. Then you can say, okay, now let me do the same on a global level with multiple data centers.
And, well, with that, one last point. Always stay pragmatic and don't try to get everything. You have to make a trade-off in some places. Like, it's either performance, it's either consistency. With principles such as quorum, I think you can fine-tune that a little bit. But the point is, don't try to get everything, because it will be A, not really possible, and you will be disappointed, and B, will become too expensive. So with that, we are at the end of our session.
Yeah. So we have a few slides for related content. If you're interested, there are a couple of interesting sessions who are covering similar stuff. For us, it is pretty important. Please rate this session. So if you find this session interesting for you, please go for it, rate it. If you think, yeah, it wasn't that interesting for me, please tell it to us, that we can improve that session, that we can learn from your requirements, because maybe we have not covered everything. Maybe you have a specific requirement, and then maybe we do the rating on your behalf. So, and when you do the rating, it would be great for us as speaker if you also provide commands, not just go this was good, 5 stars, 4 stars, or 4 points. Really give us some comments, what you think was good, and where you think, hey, this was a little bit too long, and this could have been done in a shorter time.
Okay, with that,
we're opening for questions.
Set. If you have questions, feel free to go to one of the mics or just shout at us. And if you don't have questions, thanks for your attention. It was great. It was a pleasure to be here. And with that, enjoy the Ask the Experts evening.
Okay, thank you very much.